Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The fallout over Wells Fargo's sales incentive program continues to receive national headlines, and also the allegations that it forced employees to open millions of accounts without customers' permission to reach sales targets. Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf says he will forfeit $41 million in pay and drop the program. On Capitol Hill yesterday, he was asked, "When are you going to resign?" We're going to talk about media coverage of this later in the show with David Dayan, contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His new book is Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming back.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Now we're going to talk about the situation in Syria, which continues to worsen by the day. The headline of Karim Shaheen's latest piece says it all: Hell Itself. Aleppo reels from alleged use of bunker buster bombs. People in the rebel-controlled east of the city express horror at the impact of the bombs and fears of what may come next. Karim Shaheen is a Middle East reporter for The Guardian based in Beirut. Hi, Karim. Thank you for coming back.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Karim, it just seems like the news coming out of Syria continues to get worse just when you think it can't get worse. The attempts for another ceasefire failed again. The airstrikes on the eastern part of Aleppo have intensified. In the past week, over 600 people have been killed, half of them our children. Can you bring us up to date? What is the latest?
Well, the latest is basically what you just said. It's just ongoing misery. The government has said that they plan on launching an offensive in the coming weeks to reclaim the eastern parts of the city, which have been held by the rebels since around 2012. As part of that campaign, they seem determined to basically destroy eastern Aleppo, which is what they've been doing, using increasingly violent weaponry, such as the bunker buster bombs that you mentioned at the top of the piece. They've also continued the siege. Just before we started talking, we were conversing with doctors in Aleppo, and it seems that another medical center was hit in the last few hours. The people we've been speaking to, lots of doctors, citizen journalists, activists, people living in the city, say that this is the worst that they've endured since the start of the civil war, and there's no letting up. And it seems that the aim of the government is to force them into simply giving up and surrendering.
Now, you're not able to go to Syria, so how are you able to get information about who is actually behind the airstrikes? Because as we just heard in the BBC headlines, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, is blaming the United States for protecting a jihadist group in Syria. It seems like they're on a media campaign to get this information out there. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, the Russian approach to the issue has kind of been, rather Machiavellian. I mean, they simply deny that that anything happens. The fact is, Aleppo has been the exclusive domain of the Syrian and the Russian air forces, even after the coalition began its bombing campaign against ISIS. There's simply no ISIS in Aleppo, at least inside the city itself. ISIS is known to be present in Al-Bab, which is a city outside of Aleppo, and that has been the target of coalition airstrikes and Russian airstrikes. But the city itself is completely free of ISIS. In fact, ISIS was eliminated from Aleppo City by a coalition of mostly Islamist rebels a couple of years ago. So ISIS doesn't really have a presence in Aleppo, and so there isn't that much of an incentive for the U.S. to actually carry out any bombing raids inside Aleppo itself. So the city has been, its airspace has been dominated by the Russian Air Force and by the Syrian Air Force. It's not as if this is a new thing. I mean, they've been pummeling Aleppo with barrel bombs and as well as chlorine attacks for a long time. And this latest campaign is simply a continuation of this, and is a result of the collapse of the ceasefire that was negotiated by the U.S. and Russia. So it's not a new thing. The Russians have simply taken the attitude of denying that anything is happening, denying the all the images that are coming out of Aleppo, all the reporting that's being done by doctors and by citizen journalists on the ground who have been providing us with a lot of details. You know, often these bombs are happening, you know, in their own neighborhood, in their own districts, and they're reporting on them immediately. And the Russian approach has simply been to deny that any of this happened.
Hmm. So you can confirm that Russian and Syrian jets are killing civilians and bombing hospitals, the city's pumping station, which provides water for people. This is all coming from Russian and Syrian jets.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, the Americans aren't bombing in that area. The Americans are bombing locations where ISIS is present. And ISIS is simply not present inside Aleppo City.
David Dayan, what are your thoughts on this and the way that Syria is covered for international or for United States audiences? There's not that much context in a lot of the stories. And do you think that the public knows that Russian and Syrian jets are behind the destruction of what's happening in Syria?
Absolutely not. I think when, in very celebrated fashion, Gary Johnson was on television, MSNBC recently, and was asked about Aleppo, and he said, "What is Aleppo?" I think that might reflect perhaps too much of the public in America's opinion of Aleppo as well. It's not really disseminated to any real degree. This is a civil war that has been going on for years. I get the sense that for years now the U.S. public is generally checked out. They certainly have the ability to figure this stuff out by reading, people like your other guest and the international media. But from a national standpoint, this has been pushed on to the back pages.
Hmm. And you mentioned Gary Johnson. He is the Libertarian Party presidential nominee. He was asked on MSNBC recently what he would do about the crisis in Aleppo, and he said, "What is Aleppo?" Kareem, what are your thoughts on this and how this is reported? And who's actually behind the killing of so many civilians?
Yeah, I mean, I do remember, when Gary Johnson made that statement, a lot of Aleppans were asking, "Who is Gary Johnson?" you're right. It's a difficult story to report, and we're kind of running against that wall as well. I mean, we've been reporting on the breakdown of the ceasefire, which took place over a week ago. And so this campaign of bombing civilians, has been happening for a little over a week. I think the ceasefire broke down on Thursday or Friday morning. And since then, we've been reporting on a daily basis on the carnage in the city. And at some point, you have to send the updates in the morning, and you're like, another massacre happened, and overnight, and we need to write about that. Mm. So there's a challenge of kind of reporting on a day-to-day basis, the destruction of Aleppo, which I think is necessary, because I think we need to keep these images, in the forefront. But at the same time, we're also struggling to, report something different, because the news is basically the same every day, is that dozens of people have been killed or injured. Another health facility has been attacked. Doctors are overwhelmed by the number of civilians who are coming in with severe wounds. And at some point, we have to kind of look at the, more thematic pieces. Yesterday, we did a story on all the Shia militias that are taking part, or that are planning to take part in the reclamation of Aleppo by the government. There's definitely a danger of sort of desensitizing people and inuring them to the carnage by reporting it on a daily basis, and it's a challenge we have to deal with, because Syria has been, a slow burning story. Obviously, not a slow burning story for the people inside the country, but a slow burning story for those reading about a civil war that has lasted for almost 6 years. who are international readers based in the U.S. or in Europe.
Well, and what I appreciate about your reporting, Karim, is that in addition to the political aspects of this, you also quote actual people who are still in Aleppo. I mean, so many of the headlines we get here are really about the politics and the various players. But in your latest piece, you quoted Abdulkafi Alhamdo, a teacher who's taken shelter with his wife and 7-month-old daughter. He said, quote, "When I saw it, I thought, my God, is it possible that there is so much destruction here and nobody wants to help us? At that moment, I knew that the international community had sentenced us to death, that we would be recorded as martyrs that they will weep over at some future date," end quote. You also quoted Omar Arab, a journalist who lives in the Mashhad neighborhood. He said, "I've been in Aleppo for 5 years. I've seen a lot of bombing, but the destruction of these bombs I have never seen before." How do you get these quotes out of Aleppo?
Yeah, so actually, over the last couple of weeks, a group of doctors in Aleppo and who work with Syrian American doctors in the U.S. have set up a WhatsApp group for doctors and for citizen journalists who are based inside Aleppo, along with a number of other international journalists. And I think CNN actually wrote a brief story about this group, but it includes a lot of people who are still based inside the city and who send us constant updates. You know, the other day I was scrolling through my phone looking for a photo that I'd taken a couple of weeks ago, and I realized that my phone was basically interspersed, between personal pictures and, well, my pictures of my cats and pictures of the destruction and horrific destruction and bodies and children who are arriving at the hospitals. So these guys are obviously a very helpful resource, and we've also built up our network of contacts inside the city over the past few months and years, speaking to them on a regular basis about the situation inside the city. And so, we've built a network of contacts with people who have proven reliable over the months and years that we've been reporting on Syria. We're able to cross-reference details. We're able to talk to various people who are, in the event itself, in the moment. I mean, a couple of days ago, when we reported on the destruction of two health facilities inside Aleppo City, we were actually receiving messages from one of the nurses who was inside the hospital and who was sending us messages from their shelter in the basement as they were waiting for the bombings to end. And she was telling us, she was telling the other Syrians in the group that if we do die in the hospital, please come and take us out of the rubble, but don't take our pictures because we don't want our dignity to be besmirched.
Mm. I know we have to let you go, Karim. Just quickly, what are you hearing from Syrians about what's next? How does this end? I mean, we had Abdulaziz Alhamza, a Syrian activist, on the show a couple days ago, who's in San Francisco, winning a humanitarian award. He helped found Raqqa, is being slaughtered silently. He believes that the United States could end this by bringing various parties to the table and putting pressure on them. That was his sort of solution. But what are you hearing from others?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, the U.S. doesn't really have that much leverage. The U.S. has ceded the Syrian battleground to the Russians, and that's why the Russians are calling the shots. I mean, the U.S. thought that that Russia would honor the ceasefire because the U.S. was offering the possibility of having a joint command center where the U.S. and Russia would jointly strike at ISIS militants and at Al-Qaeda militants who are based inside Syria. And the Americans, frankly, thought that this was going to be, a sufficient incentive for the Russians to cooperate and to honor the ceasefire. The fact is they miscalculated Russian intentions, and Russia is not willing to give up on its strategic interests and on its place on the table, in the fate of Syria. And so the Western powers don't really have any leverage or any, ability to pressure the Russians or the Syrian regime into doing anything they don't want or that they don't see within their strategic interests. Now, obviously, this is because of the lack of willingness to use any sort of force. We've seen before when the Syrian regime used chemical weapons against the rebels in 2013, the mere threat of U.S. action was enough to spur the regime into cooperating in the destruction of the vast majority of its chemical weapons arsenal. So without a credible threat of force, there is no way to pressure the Assad regime or to pressure the Russians into actually making any sort of concessions. And, you know, in terms of what people on the ground think, they're seeing the deployment of even more powerful munitions like the cluster bombs, like cluster munitions and bunker buster bombs, as sort of a sign that Russia can do what it wants without, you know, worrying about any punishment or any pushback from the international community beyond mere words. And that's going to remain the case until, you know, Western powers are willing to deploy more than words in the interest of getting their interests in Syria upheld.
Well, Karim, thank you for your reporting, and thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Karim Shaheen is Middle East reporter for The Guardian based in Beirut. You can find his stories, including one of his latest, Hell Itself, Aleppo Reels from Alleged Use of Bunker Buster Bombs, at yourcallradio.org. And this is Your Call's Media Roundtable. We're going to switch gears here and talk about the scandal surrounding Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf says he will forfeit $41 million in pay and drop the program. He was on Capitol Hill once again yesterday. He was asked, when are you going to resign? David Dayan is joining us for the rest of the hour, contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. We had a conversation with David just recently about his new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It's an amazing read. You can find the interview at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Dion Roberts to the show. Dion covers Charlotte's banking and financial sector for the Charlotte Observer. Wells Fargo's largest employment hub is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Dion. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, good afternoon, or good morning, I guess, in your part of the country.
Yes, good afternoon to you. Well, let's go back a little ways just to give everyone a little bit of context, because things are moving very quickly with Wells Fargo. So take us back to 2011, and that's when Wells Fargo employees started opening accounts for customers without their knowledge to meet sales goals. How did this start off, Dion?
Well, and we don't know, actually, if it goes back to 2011 or even further. I mean, during the testimony yesterday on Capitol Hill, there was, you know, some question about whether this goes back maybe to 2007 or further. And there's been some reporting by, you know, the media since the scandal became public earlier this month, September 8th, that, you know, employees say, hey, actually, this goes back further than you might think. But, you know, really, this goes back to this cross-selling push, goes back to the former head before John Stumpf, you know, his predecessor, Dick Kovacevich, who is no longer with Wells Fargo. But, you know, he was big on cross-selling. He helped to instill this culture and grow it. And, you know, the branches, which are called stores at Wells Fargo, it's the only big bank that I know of that calls its branches stores, that also goes back to Dick Kovacevich. So, you know, you're talking about 5 years at least, 6 years. Who knows how long this has been going on? But, you know, the bank says it really didn't start to bubble up as a problem internally until 2011. But that's what the bank says.
And so, David Dayan, why are we just hearing about all of this now?
Well, that's a really good question. The other one that you could ask is, why are we just hearing about it with respect to Wells Fargo? While it is true they were certainly the market leader in this idea of cross-selling, which is getting their customers to sign up for multiple different accounts, whether it was a credit card or a checking account and a savings account or a wealth management account or something like that, this seems to be endemic to the industry. There's a coalition called the Committee for Better Banks, which is composed of former line-level bank officials at branches, not just of Wells Fargo, but all sorts of regional and national banks, who say they were pressured to come up with cross-selling for their customers repeatedly and in much the same manner as Wells Fargo. It seems clear that Wells Fargo was sort of the leading precipitator of this kind of misconduct, and it's certainly the drive to sell. You know, they had a program called the Great Eight, where the target was eight different accounts per customer, and that pressure on the you know local bankers definitely led to this system of you know let's find a way out, let's come up with fake accounts, let's do whatever we can. Because there were threats of termination, there were threats of having to work unpaid overtime if people at the Wells Fargo stores didn't meet their sales goals. So while Wells Fargo was certainly number one in this field, this seems to be a problem across the industry, and it probably requires more scrutiny on the behalf of state and federal regulators.
I'll piggyback on what David is talking about because he brings up a very good point. Earlier this summer, back in June, there was this congressional briefing called Banking on the Hard Sell, which was named after this report that the National Employment Law Center helped to put out in Committee for Better Banks. And, you know, this was a congressional briefing, and it was based on the findings of a new study that the National Employment Law Center had put out, which just showed that retail bank workers are often subject to unfair working conditions and low pay. That's I'm citing, you know, from the organization that was involved in this report. But you know, bank teller wages, you know, critics say have remained stagnant for decades. And keep in mind that the bonus that these personal bankers are making for meeting their sales goals, this is not. You know, this is not a bonus that people are using to go out and buy a Rolex. I mean, my wife was a personal banker, not for Wells Fargo, but she was a personal banker for a major bank a few years ago, and this was an issue back when she was a banker. If she didn't meet her sales goals and there was intense pressure, you know, we couldn't have the kind of lifestyle that we wanted. We couldn't buy groceries, maybe, or we had to shrink our grocery bill. We couldn't go out to the movies. I mean, you know, these frontline bankers, this was like, you know, eat or starve if you didn't meet your sales goals and get your bonus, or they could get fired. So this is a high-stakes game, and it's not just at Wells Fargo.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
I'm glad you brought this up, because this isn't getting that much attention with all of the Wells Fargo scandal coverage. A study released by the National Employment Law Project last year found that 30% of the almost 2 million retail banking employees across the country, it's about 500,000 workers, are paid less than $15 an hour. Nearly three-quarters of low-wage bank workers are bank tellers. 84% are women. And based on my experience over the years, so many women of color.
Absolutely. And when Wells Fargo is telling you, you need to meet these sales goals, and if you don't, we're going to keep you late that day so that you can catch up, that's wage theft. I mean, that is working unpaid overtime. And in fact, members of the Senate Banking Committee, Democrats on the committee who questioned John Stump, appealed to the Department of Labor and said, you need to do a thorough investigation. To look into labor law violations committed by Wells Fargo in this case, and the Labor Department said they would. They are doing a top to bottom review. So while the labor law violations aren't really at the forefront of this scandal, it's certainly the entire undercurrent, because Wells Fargo clearly created an environment, and these other banks as well, apparently, where workers had to perform this activity, or they would be basically have their labor stolen. That this is sort of the textbook definition of wage theft. If you're you know working overtime without being paid for it.
David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. We're also joined by Dion Roberts. He covers Charlotte's banking and financial sector for the Charlotte Observer. Wells Fargo's largest employment hub is in Charlotte, North Carolina. We are talking about continued media coverage of the fallout of the Wells Fargo sales incentive program and allegations that it forced employees to open millions of accounts without customers' permission to reach sales targets. What are your thoughts on the extensive coverage that this is getting? A lot of people are saying, why didn't the media focus on banks back in 2008 during the financial crisis like they are now? And what are the questions that aren't being raised? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it'll be Inflection Point here on 91.7 KALW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about media coverage of Wells Fargo. You may have heard that Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf says he will forfeit $41 million in pay and drop this program in which employees were forced to open millions of accounts without customers' permission to reach target sales. According to the New York Times, Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf's holdings add up to $109 million in stock, plus more than $24 million in pension and 401k benefits. Today we're talking about coverage with Dion Roberts. He covers Charlotte's banking and financial sector for the Charlotte Observer. Wells Fargo's largest employment hub is in Charlotte. David Diane is a contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist with the Fiscal Times. We talked to David recently about his new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. It's a jaw-dropping book. I hope you can take a read it and listen to our interview. You can search for it at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Dion, I only have one bank account. I'm still unclear about these eight accounts. Can you tell us more about that? How did the employees force people to, or how did the employees open millions of accounts without customers' permission? How did they not know this was happening?
Well, you know, what would happen is, you know, according to regulators and you know, the city and county of Los Angeles, which sued the bank last year over this issue, you know, these employees were just covertly opening accounts in customers' names without customers, you know, without their permission. And in some cases, you know, a customer would get a letter or some other kind of notification from Wells Fargo saying, congratulations for, you know, applying for a credit card. And it was at that point that, you know, customers maybe first learned that they, you know, they were getting something that they didn't ask for. And, you know, according to the allegations, which I guess it's important to note that Wells Fargo did not admit to or deny in its settlement agreement, although it has apologized profusely, you know, at these congressional hearings. But, you know, according to the allegations, employees were using fake email addresses and other tactics to carry out this operation for a period of years that started in 2011, ran into this year.
And how was the company able to make so much money off of these fake accounts?
Well, and that's where, you know, the people who are defending the bank sort of, that's one of the things that they point to, is they say, look, the bank didn't really make that much money at the end of the day off of this. You know, they've reimbursed customers to the tune of like $2.6 million in fees that, you know, people were hit with, customers were hit with because of these accounts being open without them knowing about it. And so really when you think about the billions of dollars that Wells Fargo makes every quarter, in the grand scheme of things, $2.6 million is not a lot of revenue. However, what critics of the bank say is that, look, this might not have enriched the bank's financial statements, but it helped to promote the bank's stock to investors who were hearing from the CEO repeatedly on earnings calls that, you know, we are pushing to get 8 products per customer. We've hit a record cross-sale goal this quarter of 5.8, 5.9, 6 products per household. To investors, that sounded like a strategy that was working really well. The stock price rises as a result of that, and the executives who hold millions of dollars in shares, they profit from the stock price rising. And that was a point that Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, a Democrat from Massachusetts, made last week when she was grilling John Stumpf.
And David, what would you add?
Yeah, Dion's absolutely right about this. This is a securities fraud case, or if you will. The money is that was made on these accounts is in some ways inadvertent. It's inadvertent fees through moving funds from one account to another and getting overdraft charges. That was not the purpose of this. The purpose was to show sales growth to investors, so investors would in turn purchase the stock and boost the price. The price doubled over the course of about a 5-year period from 2010 to 2015, when they Wells Fargo was touting these cross-selling attributes, both in earnings calls and actually in the Securities and Exchange Commission filings that they did. They would mention these cross-selling metrics in every single one of these filings and in every single one of these earnings calls. And, of course, what we know is that John Stumpf himself had stock in the company. And Carolyn Maloney, a congresswoman, Democrat from New York, yesterday noted that right around the time that Stumpf acknowledges that he started to learn about the cross-selling scandal and about the opening of fake accounts in October of 2013, he sold $13 million worth of the stock on the open market.
Wow.
And Maloney alleges that as soon as Stumpf found out that this was all based on fakery, he sold high. This is a much bigger scandal when you take into account the fact that Wells Fargo's entire identity was wrapped up with cross-selling. It was wrapped up in the idea that they could get the most out of their customers, and this was their brand, and this is what they were selling to investors. And the fact that it was all based, or at least a portion of it was based on fakery, is the essence of this scandal.
I'm still trying to find out where the money came from. A friend who banks with Wells said that over the past couple of years, his annual fee has gone up. But how is it that people were paying money for these fake accounts without knowing about it?
Well, one of the ways I described was with regard to the funding of the accounts. The incentives would not go forward for the bank customers until the accounts were funded. In other words, money was put into these accounts. So what they would do is they would transfer money from a customer's existing and real account into the fake account for the sole purpose of getting this incentive bonus for the fake account. However, when they did that, and if the customer was spending money out of that account and didn't have the money there because it was drawn into the fake account, they would get hit with an overdraft charge. So that was one way in which this would happen. Another way is that there might be some annual fees or some sort of maintenance fee on the fake account, like on a credit card, if you have an annual fee on it. If that would get hit in, then you would get charged for this account that you didn't even know you had. Again, as Dion said, it's a minimal part of what this was really about. This was about boosting the stock price. And when you're talking about boosting the stock price, that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Wells Fargo and to its executives, even specifically, if not billions of dollars, rather than the millions of dollars, the relatively less that you get just in the raw dollars of fees from these these fake accounts.
And it's a good point, because we often talk about CEO pay. We don't talk about stock options very much. And David, in one of your latest pieces, you point out that John Stumpf took $155 million in stock options between 2012 and 2015. Just over the course of 3 years, $155 million?
Yeah, this is, performance pay. Is often what CEOs and executives are paid in because of various tax reasons. It makes sense for the company. They can deduct it from their business expenses if it's based in so-called performance pay, which is usually stock options. What was clawed back from John Stumpf was $41 million in what are called unvested stock options that haven't been exercised yet. However, he has a grand total of, I believe, about $240 million in stock in Wells Fargo. So that gives him an incentive. The idea from the company, what they would tell you is it aligns his incentives with making the company better, but certainly it aligns its incentives with making the stock rise, and that doesn't necessarily correlate. And in this case, making the stock rise meant touting cross-selling and making sure that investors knew that the company was growing. By any means necessary, that creates the culture that leads to retail bankers having to make all these accounts happen.
Dion, you cover Charlotte's banking and financial sector for the Charlotte Observer. How common is this to take in $155 million in stock options over the course of 3 years for a bank CEO?
Well, it's not. It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon for that much stock to be awarded to the CEO of a bank or a large corporation in general. What we've seen since the financial crisis, and maybe even starting before that, there's been a pressure from investors and just regulators to award executives compensation, more of their compensation in stock, particularly stock that is performance-based, restricted stock that they can't touch unless the company meets certain performance metrics. And, this is a way of, one of the arguments for that is that it, prevents, undue risks. It also aligns, the interests of the executives with those of shareholders, meaning, you create long-term value in this company, right, and you get awarded these stock awards, but you don't get them right away. You basically have to earn them to touch them. So it's not uncommon, and so what you're seeing is just a lot of stock is awarded because it used to be, these people would be paid way more in cash bonuses and base salary and other types of perks, and so this is just a way of kind of offsetting, the cash portion of their compensation being reduced over, recent years.
And really, it's also about tax law. It's actually Bill Clinton that instituted this thing that was a cap on how much a company could deduct from an individual executive's salary as a business expense. You can only deduct $1 million. So if your base pay is over $1 million, a company does not get to deduct more than $1 million in cash. However, if you give it to them in performance-based pay, they can deduct all of that. So the drive and the move towards performance-based pay is largely about the tax code and the way that companies can achieve deductions just by giving out stock.
David Dayan is a contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His new book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. We had David on recently. You can find that interview at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Dion Roberts. He covers Charlotte's banking and financial sector for the Charlotte Observer. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on the extensive media coverage that Wells Fargo is getting? What questions do you still have about what happened? And what about overall media coverage about the banking sector in the United States? Toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. And let's hear from Ray in San Francisco. Hi, Ray. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Around 2011, I've been with Wells Fargo since 1980, but around 2011, there was always money missing from my accounts, and I asked my friends, anyone that had Wells Fargo, if they were missing money, and they all said yes. And it turned out that my banker in North Beach there had been opening accounts, and on her screen, when she punched it up, I had all of these other accounts, but on my screen, I could never get access to those. And it turned out that she was having the mail for those accounts routed back to her office there.
Wow. So what did you do about it?
I could never get it straightened out, really. I just, it gave me a lot of sleepless hours, and I never really did get it straightened out. It was just really frustrating.
Wow. Did you lose money?
Yeah, probably altogether $500 or so.
Wow. Well, that sure adds up. And Ray, are you still with Wells Fargo? Did we lose? Okay, we lost Ray. Is that a common story, Dion?
For somebody to, well, we don't know if he's still with the bank. I just talked to someone today who, is in Charlotte and says that he went through this situation, of having accounts opened in his name without him knowing about it. He's since changed banks. Is it common? I mean, Wells Fargo said that it this probably happened to 2 million of its customers. It says it's not sure. The way it couches this is it's not sure whether those 2 million accounts were actually authorized by customers. And I think it's something that's important to point out in all of this. You know, at the end of the day, the bank hasn't actually come out and said 2 million accounts were indeed unauthorized. It doesn't even know. It doesn't even know. So it's not even they don't even have a handle internally on whether, all of these accounts were unauthorized or not. They're just saying that, we think this universe of 2 million people, may have had some fraud conducted against them.
Yeah, I would just add that, we've been talking about how employees and investors might have been affected by this. As far as the individual consumers, it's not just whether or not Wells Fargo imposed unnecessary and unauthorized fees. When you get hit with an overdraft fee or a late fee or some sort of drain on your account like that, that gets reported to credit bureaus. And it can be very difficult for individual customers to get those things off of their credit report. And, of course, that affects if they go in for credit, go in for a mortgage loan or a car loan or anything like that. It affects the interest rate that they get. So this could be a very large problem for an individual, even if it's a $35 fee from overdraft. It could be a much bigger event for an individual customer and cause a lot of unnecessary hardship.
Right, and in addition to your credit report, David's absolutely right. In addition to your credit report, this customer I talked to today here in Charlotte who was impacted by this, he said that he suffered other collateral damage when he had these accounts opened without his knowledge, he says. Money was transferred from one of his accounts to another. He wasn't able to fund projects. This guy was a businessman. He ran a business. He lost contracts because he wasn't able to fund certain projects, and he ended up just basically having to dissolve his business as a result of this. And so, it's not just the fee that you incurred as a customer. It's not just the credit report, but it's all the other ways that this kind of, the ripple effects through a person's life.
Wow. Well, Ray just called back to say he is still with Wells Fargo. I've been hearing from a lot of people who are closing their Wells Fargo accounts. David, Diane, does this make any difference?
Well, where it might make a difference is on the reputation of Wells Fargo and specifically the career prospects of John Stumpf. Mm. This was a bank that was seen as, relatively speaking, above the fray. They tried to cultivate that image. They didn't get involved in derivatives. This is kind of where the reputation of the bank was in terms of their own personal public relations. And now that has been torched, and this is why you saw the the Wells Fargo's board do this clawback of stock money from both John Stumpf and Carrie Tolstead, who was the head of community banking, who retired with a pay package, something on the order, Fortune magazine reported, of around $125 million. She was she had $19 million of that clawed back. You know, Stumpf I think by all media reports, did not do terribly well in these hearings in Congress, and I would venture that he's kind of hanging by a thread right now, as far as whether or not he's going to have to step down. This is a serious reputational risk for Wells Fargo. Like you said, an exodus of customers, just generally a stain on their corporate image, and it might be, in their eyes, the only way that they can remedy that is by, you know, getting rid of John Stumpf.
And also here in California on Wednesday, California's Treasurer John Chang announced that the state will stop using Wells Fargo as the managing underwriter on bond sales. Last year, the bank managed $700 million of bond sales. These will be suspended. I mean, this is a massive amount of money for California. There was also a piece in the Chronicle about Wells Fargo in San Francisco and politicians in California who have vowed or not vowed yet to give Wells Fargo's money back. Nancy Pelosi, Congresswoman, received $7,500 from the bank's Political Action Committee. Senator Dianne Feinstein said in a statement that she also expected Wells Fargo would face consequences. Open Secrets does not list Barbara Boxer as having received contributions from Wells Fargo. And so this was a good article just looking at what's happening here in California. And let's go to our next caller, Anne in Berkeley. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Has there been any conversation at all? I haven't heard it. But first, thank you so much for this program. It's so good. Any conversation on the people who were fired getting their jobs back?
Oh, good question.
I can take that
Wells Fargo fired 5,300 managers and staff.
Correct. So the 5,300 are branch, you know, people in branches, branch managers, managers of those managers, and a regional president, if I'm remembering that correctly. So no senior executives, as far as we know, have been fired over this. As far as what happens to the employees who were let go, you know, that came up yesterday during the hearing in Congress. You know, lawmakers were asking, some of these people, you know, might have been doing the right thing. You know, in some cases, what if somebody was let go because they just didn't meet their sales goals? You know, what are you going to do for all these employees you've been letting go over the years? And John Stumpf, you know, said, well, we're going to go back and take a look. You know, we certainly don't want to, you know, have anyone. We don't want to sort of make anyone whole if we did the wrong thing. But I didn't hear like a real plan from him yesterday to kind of go back and you know, address those kinds of concerns.
Yeah, I think it's key to understand that there are two sort of buckets of people who were fired by Wells Fargo. The 5,300 allegedly represents people who actually wrote and issued these false accounts. But what we're hearing from the Committee for Better Banks and from individuals at Wells Fargo is that there's this whole other universe of people who were fired because they refused to create fake accounts, because they didn't meet their sales goals. And there are reports that people who called the internal whistleblower line at Wells Fargo and blew the whistle on the fact that these fake accounts were being created were retaliated against and fired. And that is just a whole other element of this, and another very serious charge, that if you are using your whistleblower line to identify and then retaliate against workers within your own company, that violates several laws. And that's a much bigger issue that Wells Fargo is going to have to deal with.
Mm. We have another question from a caller who can't stay on the line. What will the outcome be? Because this probably will not be resolved during the Obama administration. According to the San Francisco Chronicle article, Wells Fargo's political contributions went to the RNC, the Republican National Committee. That was the top recipient at $287,000. Second on the list, Hillary Clinton, $258,000. David Dayan, has Hillary Clinton spoken out on this?
She wrote an open letter to Wells Fargo customers saying that she understands their situation and will work to fix it. I remember being at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, which was took place at the Wells Fargo Center. That's the name of the facility. So this is going to play out over the course of several months. I thought one thing that was interesting that came out of yesterday's hearings was Maxine Waters, who's the ranking Democrat of the House Financial Services Committee, actually brought up the idea that Wells Fargo should be broken up over this, that the company is simply too big to manage its affairs. And that is something that doesn't really get talked about in Washington very often. And so if we're going there with this, if Wells Fargo becomes the poster child for this idea that these banks, as they get so big, become just simply unmanageable and unable to detect the fraud going on under their noses, then this could have really wide-ranging ramifications.
And Dion Roberts, final thoughts, 30 seconds. Where do you think this will go?
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump. You know, he said before that he wants to break up the big banks, and that doesn't bode well for Wells Fargo's prospects in the future. You know, Maxine Waters, who's down there in Los Angeles, she sort of pledged yesterday to push to break up the banks. So, you know, Hillary Clinton doesn't sound like she's too happy with Wells Fargo. Donald Trump has said that he wants to break up the big banks. I think either way the election goes in November, it doesn't look like it might be good for Wells Fargo.
Mm. Another caller said we need to do more to promote credit unions and community banks. We'll definitely do another show about that. Thanks for that email and phone call. Dion Roberts is a banking reporter with the Charlotte Observer. David Dayan is contributing writer to Salon and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David and Dion, thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. Have a good weekend. This is Your Call.